What do you see on the horizon for financial markets? From uncertainty to opportunity, PGIM can help you rise to the challenges of today, when disciplined risk management is needed most. With $1.2 trillion in AUM and deep expertise across asset classes, our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
Is realizing the full value of your network just a dream? Intel is bringing AI everywhere, building solutions to help modernize and monetize 5G infrastructure, making it possible for telecommunications providers to expand services and drive efficiency by reducing costs and saving energy. The next wave of networks starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Odd Lots podcast. I'm Tracy Alloway.
And I'm Joe Weisenthal.
Joe, I feel like 2020 has been such an unusual and crazy year with a lot of things going on that there's actually some pretty important news that hasn't gotten as much attention as it would normally. If it was any other year, I think a lot of people would be reading about this and talking about this, at least in the sort of investment industry.
Yeah, it's kind of like how, news you might like put out on a Friday and no one really notices it. It's like all of 2020 is like the Friday news dump because you could put, there's so much other stuff to pay attention to. The virus, obviously, the economic shock and the election, that no one really has had the bandwidth for anything else.
Yeah, that's a really good way of putting it. So the event that I'm talking about that I don't think has gotten as much attention as it normally would is basically a debt crisis in Africa. And this month, we're recording in November. So this month, Zambia actually defaulted on some bonds, and it's the first sort of COVID-related default by an African nation. And a lot of people expect there will be more, even though we've seen some countries, some creditors, the G20 agree a few efforts to try to help indebted countries in Africa. There's a G20 debt service suspension initiative. But even with that aid, people are expecting distress in Africa's debt market to get probably worse before it gets better.
I think you're right. Like if a Zambian debt default would have been the kind of thing we're like, oh, let's do an episode on that much earlier. But in 2020, yes, it's certainly gotten less attention than I think
it gets lost.
You know, it's one of those things where I'm sure I even saw headlines on it and I meant to ask more questions in a meeting one day and meant to click on it and learn more. And I didn't. Because, again, I probably had, like, you know, some question about what's going on with the presidential transition or something that took over my mind for the day.
You mean you weren't thinking purely of Zambia?
Believe it or not.
In a meeting in New York. So in the midst of all this debt distress in Africa, there's also a lot of attention being paid to China and its role in building up that excess debt, but also what China is going to do. Now that Africa is, you know, economically stressed, is China going to let up on some of those debt payments in the same way that maybe multilateral organizations or other creditors are thinking about doing? So we're going to get into that side of the African debt crisis quite a bit as well. But more than that, we're going to talk about how that debt buildup actually happened, and we're going to do it in a slightly different way. We have someone who obviously comes from Africa, from Liberia, and who had an official role in the Liberian government. And a lot of that role involved, you know, being involved in infrastructure projects for which you would incur debt. You take out a loan so you could build a bridge or a road or a railway or something like that. And so we're going to get a different perspective on Africa's debt problem.
Excellent. Really looking forward to this.
Okay, great. So without further ado, then, I want to bring in our guest, Jude Moore. He's a senior policy fellow at the Center for Global Development. He previously served as Liberia's Minister for Public Works and was also Deputy Chief of Staff to the President. So, like I said, a lot of experience in a government position within Africa, and it's going to be fascinating to hear his perspective. Jude, thanks so much for coming on.
Hey, morning, guys, and thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So I remember the first time I ever went to Africa, I went to Mozambique back in 2010. And one of the things that really struck me and that I found quite weird at the time was if you were in Maputo, the capital, everything was Chinese. The cars were Chinese, the trucks were Chinese, the stadium was built by the Chinese. There were Chinese characters all over the place. It's really, really striking the extent to which China has become involved in the Africa market. Why has that happened?
Yeah, and if you had gone to, say, Ethiopia, if you'd gone to Addis, you would have seen the same thing. And across the continent, and to a large extent, especially even in Zambia that you spoke about, you would have seen the same thing. There's been an extensive growth in terms of Chinese presence and a deepening of Chinese relationship with African countries. A part of that, I guess, is historical. One is that, you know, at the turn of the century, when, you know, we're worried about Y2K, China is entering the WTO, but China also unveils its first going out strategy. And the only uncontested region in the world in which Chinese, because they weren't as powerful as they are now, could go was the region of the world in which, you know, most Western policy toward Africa at the time was filtered through the lenses of humanitarian assistance and development. Africa wasn't seen as a place to go and do business. And for China, it worked out perfectly because there wasn't a peer competitor there. I mean, there were some European engagement, but it wasn't to the extent that the Chinese would do. The second thing was just the need that was on the continent and what China could provide. So even up to today, Africa still lags every other region of the world in terms of the provision of infrastructure, mainly paved roads and power. More than 600 million people on the continent still lack access to electricity. And so China had this excess capacity in providing infrastructure and normally provide infrastructure at cost, right? So before the arrival of the Chinese, the infrastructure space in Africa had been dominated by European firms. We're talking about your Bouygues, your Eiffage, the large Vinci, the large French, Spanish, and to a certain extent Italian firms. But the costs of infrastructure from those firms tended to be high. And the Chinese came and were able to, first Chinese firms were state sponsored. And so they were state owned firms and could therefore, they had access to capital that was much cheaper and could provide infrastructure. So at cost that they were competitive in terms of cost. The second reason was simply because they brought money with them. In a lot of instances, there were African countries who couldn't afford to pay for this upfront, and the Chinese were willing to extend loans to them. And so for a lot of African countries, which at the time didn't have access to international financial markets to issue sovereign bonds and stuff, for whom development financing from the multilateral institutions was just not enough, especially concessional financing. And so with nowhere else to go, they were happy for a partner who seemed not to worry too much about public financial management, who seemed not to care about the quality of governance in terms of corruption, and who said those things were internal and they had nothing to do with that. And so there was this a confluence of interest between what China wanted to do at the time and what Africa's needs were. And so because of that, we saw a huge ramp up in terms of African debt. Now, the final thing I would say to that also was that it coincided with this huge buildup in terms of a boom for commodity exports. And most African economies were growing at, you know, 7 to 9%. And China seemed to have an insatiable appetite for African commodities. And so it, like, everybody was invited to the party, and the party went really well for a while.
So lots of things came together in sort of an ideal manner for both parties or for multiple parties. What years, just to help us frame the conversation, we talk about this boom and we talk about this buildup, this eventual debt buildup. What years are we talking about in terms of when this really got going and when this sort of really hit its transactional peak?
Yeah, so I'd say it started in 2000 at the first FOCAC. So the FOCAC is the Forum on China-Africa Cooperation. It's held every 3 years. And the first one, I think 43 African heads of state and governments arrived in China, and it's been held every 3 years. And this is when China says, over the next 3 years, we're going to invest, you know, 5 billion or 20 billion. It went up at the last two FOCACs, the 2015 and the 2018 FOCACs, China pledged to spend up to $60 billion in Africa. So the ramp up starts maybe around 2006. In terms of the numbers begin to increase around then, but the Chinese arrival in this form that we're seeing begins around 2000. And then financial crisis of 2008 basically left China like unchallenged. I think a lot of the global recovery was driven by the Chinese spending on capital projects. And at the end of that, China was left with this excess capacity that had to go somewhere. I mean, I think a lot of that is what drove even the Belt and Road Initiative. But with that excess capacity, we saw an even significant ramp up of Chinese spending. So you go back and look at Zambia's a debt profile in terms of the accumulation of debt in a place like Zambia. Well, most African countries were beneficiaries first of the debt waivers under HIPC, right? And the Jubilee, the activity around waiving debt. And so come around 2010, 2011, a lot of African countries suddenly have significant space to borrow again. And so with China left with this excess capacity, we see this significant ramp up of Chinese lending for infrastructure on the continent.
What do you see on the horizon for financial markets? From uncertainty to opportunity, PGIM can help you rise to the challenges of today when disciplined risk management is needed most. With $1.2 trillion in AUM and deep expertise across asset classes, our investments shape tomorrow today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
So this is one thing I always wondered, but well, actually, okay, I have two questions. So first of all, could you maybe describe a little bit more what these Chinese infrastructure deals actually look like and how they work? So you had things operating under official state sanctioned banners like the Belt and Road Initiative, but you also had private Chinese companies who would come in and tender offers alongside European and American companies or companies from anywhere in the world. How did those actually work? And then secondly, if China was financing a lot of this infrastructure build, Africa is still enormously behind on infrastructure, obviously. Like, why didn't it make more of a difference? Why aren't there, you know, bridges and railways and airports and things like that all over?
Like everywhere.
Yeah.
I think first, that's a really good question. I think first is just the baseline. We're coming from, you have to remember toward the end, between 1989 and say the year 2000, that the continent is ravaged by a number of crises, right? First, there are a significant amount of civil wars, the Liberian Civil War, the Sierra Leone Civil War, the Rwandan genocide, Mogadishu, even Mozambique, we talked about. There's a significant amount of wars, and a lot of infrastructure is either not built or destroyed during these wars. right? And then because of those wars, we saw a lot of humanitarian crises, right? But at the same time, we had an AIDS pandemic that was wiping out a significant number of the population across Central and Southern Africa. And so a significant amount of money that was available went toward the health crisis, went toward just basically meeting needs, and not a lot was done in terms of infrastructure. And so the baseline from which we come means that in spite of all the ramp up we did, we only just scratched the surface. The African Development Bank now puts the gap in terms of infrastructure financing to around up to $103 billion a year. So you can imagine how deep the hole was in terms of what was available. And the way it worked, you're right. There were like three nodes of Chinese engagement. There were your large state-owned companies that were owned by the central government. And then there were your provincial companies. And then finally, you had these like quasi-private companies. Each of them came with the promise of the backing of Chinese policy banks. So they were always promised that they could get you access to financing once the government, I mean, what they required was a sovereign guarantee. They needed the government to back that loan. And if the government did, and because you have so many actors, it would seem to me, I don't know that as much about how the Chinese system works on their side. But for example, if I went to the World Bank, say the Ministry of Public Works engaged the World Bank, most of that engagement would happen through the Ministry of Finance. The World Bank would then look at Liberia's debt portfolio and be able to say, you can't afford this, right? On the Chinese side, it just seemed not to have worked like that. So you had multiple Chinese companies that are competing. So there's a provincial company, a construction company that is accessing finance somehow. It has a line of credit that it can extend or is working through the provincial branch of the Exim Bank. And then you have the large state-owned company. And it seemed as if there weren't some sort of a central node that processed all of it to be able to say, no, it looks like Zambia has taken a lot more debt than Zambia can afford. You see what I mean? Like that didn't seem to be, if there were, it was almost, maybe it was ignored. Or it just didn't exist. Whatever the reason was, a lot of countries, a few countries, not a lot of them, like your Zambias, say South Sudan and Angola, were allowed to ramp up significant amount of debt. And that was tied, to be honest, to commodity exports that seemed to be going up and up and up. And so I would like to add, though, that beyond the just huge infrastructure deficit, there was another thing driving Africa's need to borrow from China to finance this. Everywhere else in the world, as a population has either stabilized or is declining, right? Except in Africa, where the population continues to grow, where more than 50% of the population, I think, is under 19. And because of this huge increase in the population, governments are under significant pressure to provide both, hard physical infrastructure and social infrastructure for these. And so there are all of these. And then Africa's exports tend to be largely unprocessed natural resource products. And because of that, we're so low down the value chain that what accrues to us as value from our exports is just not enough to be able to finance our infrastructure. And so because of that, like all of these pressures on governments. And the final thing I would say to that is also, it seems counterintuitive, but it was like the more democratic a country became, the closer it came to China. Why? Because when we ran our elections, we promised people that we would build infrastructure because that was the largest need. And so when the elections ended, and we needed to deliver on the promises we made, China was one of the few who had both the appetite for our risk and the resources to be able to lend us money to build the infrastructure we needed. And so all of these, I guess, all of these forces and factors sort of just created this perfect, I don't want to call it a storm, but just created a perfect circumstance for this Chinese lending to Africa and Africa borrowing from China.
So there was no entity, whether it's on the provincial or policy bank side in China, or the governments of the various African countries that were the recipients of this loan money and infrastructure capacity, no one had an incentive to do any sort of meaningful debt sustainability analysis.
It sounds like that, doesn't it? It just seems, it seemed that way. On our side in Liberia, we really didn't have the, we didn't really have the option to do that. Because you see, we just come out of a war and almost $5 billion of our debt had been waived. But that meant we had to enter an IMF program, which meant at the Ministry of Finance in Liberia, there was a person there from the IMF who reviewed our debt profile. And in Liberia, we had something called the Debt Management Committee that reviewed every application for debt from, say, an agency or government ministry and measured that against our debt stock and this debt servicing. And we just come back to say, we just couldn't afford this. It doesn't seem that that kind of infrastructure, that kind of, you know, institutional arrangement existed across the continent. And in instances where it did, it just seemed like the incentives weren't aligned for people to actually give it the power to operate as it should. Then on the Chinese side, it just, there didn't seem to be a significant effort. It looks like that's changing now, though. It started to change around the 2018 FOCAC when Xi Jinping began talking about, you know, we're no longer going to finance, you know, vanity projects or political projects, they call them. I think something started to change about it. It might have been because of domestic reasons. It might have been China's own position in terms of how much capital it had to be able to expand overseas. Something began to change. But in those, you know, in the heyday of borrowing that has us in the crisis that we're in now in a number of African countries, I would say maybe like seven in which Chinese debt is actually a driver of debt distress, that didn't seem to be on the Chinese side in some sort of coordination to be able to take. And the final thing I would say on that is that we know that China has been sort of like a reluctant multilateralist, that China was not a member of the Paris Club. And the Paris Club of rich countries had debt sustainability rules. And because China wasn't a part of it, it wasn't really subject to those rules.
Reluctant multilateralist is a great way of putting it. I want to talk more about how China's approach might be changing, especially this summer during the debt crisis. But before we do, I mean, I think we have to talk a little bit more about the loan. So there is a perception that China's loans tend to be, or its financing tend to be unfair in some way, or they come with a lot of strings attached, and that, you know, China maybe doesn't necessarily care about debt sustainability because it's trying to, how do I put it? Like, it's trying to get a hook into a particular country or into a particular resource or a strategic port or something like that. So it's not necessarily worried about getting paid back. So how much is that reputation deserved in your view?
So I think it was first, it was an Indian writer writing an op-ed in an Indian paper who coined the phrase debt trap diplomacy. And then the US in its grid power competition with the Chinese simply ramp that up. And my understanding of the narrative of debt trap diplomacy is that the whole plan is for China to ensnare its putative partners in this unhealthy relationship as a means of being able to take over flagship infrastructure like ports and airports and stuff like that. And the example that gets bandied about is Hambantota. You know, in Sri Lanka. Yeah. In Africa, so there's been a lot of studies, the China-Africa Research Initiative at Johns Hopkins University has done a study on this, and there's no evidence for this. It gets repeated often, but there's no real evidence for this. The second thing I would say on this question is that about seven countries in Africa, seven or eight, the debt crisis they have currently, the debt distress, China plays a role, right? So in terms of Africa's total debt stock, China is responsible for about 20% of it. So it sort of seems like we've become so consumed with talking about the 20% and not focused on the 80%, right? A significant portion of the debt is owed to domestic creditors and to private creditors. And then the rest of it is the multilateral lending agencies. And so it's worked really well to the U.S.'s advantage in terms of painting China as this irresponsible lender who's out to take over the infrastructure of the countries it supposedly is working with. It hasn't really borne out in terms of the evidence that this is what the Chinese, but the question is, I think the critique of Chinese lending at a scale and pace that was just completely sustainable, especially for economies who were dependent on commodity exports, knowing the fluctuations of commodity exports. I mean, I think COVID-19 simply ended up being an accelerant of a crisis that was coming anyway, right? And so we just didn't expect it to be this shock, but it was coming anyway. And Zambia had always been there. I would also like to point out that Zambia is a bit different, right, from other countries in terms of how quickly the debt ramped up in Zambia and how much debt it actually had and how dependent it is on a single export, copper. I think we were fortunate enough that the picture out of Africa after the Zambian debt default is going to be mixed. So on Friday, either Thursday or Friday, Cote d'Ivoire went to the market, becoming the first African country since COVID to issue Eurobonds, and it was 5 times oversubscribed. So it appears that the market is being really nuanced and sophisticated about the risk that African countries present. And there still seems to be some sort of appetite for African debt. And so I think China as a factor in Africa, again, we're talking about 54 economies and China being a significant impact. Part of maybe 7 or 8. And then if you take out Angola, China's influence drops in like significantly because a significant portion of Africa's debt to China is actually Angola's debt to China. And then, of course, you have your Kenya. That's changing because, you know, at the last FOCAC, Kenya went with the hope of getting more money for the second and final portion of the standard gauge rail from, you know, currently it comes from Mombasa to Nairobi. It's supposed to go further than that. And the Chinese played hardball and didn't. Because first, the current one is not able to pay its bills. The debt is very difficult for them to service. In fact, there was a committee in the Kenyan parliament who suggested go back to the Chinese to say, look, we're in over our heads. We can't do this. The DSSI you mentioned, Kenya initially didn't want to participate because Kenya still wants to retain its access to markets. But Kenya is strongly reconsidering that decision at the moment. So I think to just paint China as the driver of debt, especially with, you know, nefarious intents, it's just the evidence just really, really doesn't bear that out.
So Chinese debt is an important contributor to the total debt stock, but it's not the only story. I want to go back to something you said a little bit earlier on, and we were talking about this perfect storm of there being an opportunity, China looking at Africa and seeing there wasn't really any sort of other main entity there from a business standpoint. Most of the Western dollars came more from a foreign aid perspective than an investment perspective. Is there a strategic opportunity now, or is it just never made any sense? I mean, if the countries where China has been very active in lending are largely commodity exporters, obviously China has this voracious demand for these commodities. Do other sort of Western players, whether it's the U.S. or countries in Europe, have much of a sort of strategic business reason to invest aggressively in Africa, or do they just not have the same calculations that would lead them there in the first place due to their sort of, you know, different needs of their economies?
Sure. And just quickly before I respond to that, I would just add that part of what drove, you know, China's investment in African resources was also this need to have access to the resources at source, right? Because China could always buy them on the international market. It could buy them from Glencore, right? But the certain mineral resources were considered strategic, and they wanted Chinese companies controlling them. And so that drove that. I think this is a question, I'm glad you bring up this question about, you know, beyond China, or is there a strategic reason for others to be engaged with the continent now? So one of the things that we've seen is the rise of these continent-sized economies, right, that dominate the global landscape now in terms of the political economy of the world. So you have the United States, you have the combined EU, you have your China, you have India, and they're dominant. And compared to Africa, where you have 54 fragmented, very small states. I mean, the largest economy in Africa is Nigeria, but Nigeria's GDP is still smaller than the Washington, D.C. area, right? So it is, I mean, it might be large for Africa, but in terms of a global scale, it's really not. I mean, it's just it has a lot of people. And then up to 90% of Nigeria's revenue come from oil exports. So Nigeria's large economy is still pretty fragile, especially because now we're going to a post-carbon economy. So what the African leaders, they understood their inherent weakness of acting as individual units. And so they decided to create something called the Africa Continental Free Trade Area, which would combine all of their markets into a single market, and by doing that, become a $3 trillion market. So now it makes Africa attractive as a place to invest, because initially, if you were going to invest in any country, you had to, and wanted to scale up across the continent, you had to, you know, deal with 54, if you wanted a presence in all countries, but 54 regulatory environments. That is just way too expensive. And you know, the payout, the dividend doesn't seem to match the cost. But because now it's going to be a single market, it might be more attractive, right? And so I think with that change, it's really, really important that people begin to take a second look at Africa. The second thing is, you know, over the last 10 months, the large economies, I mean, they've spent close to is it $10 to $12 trillion propping up the economies against the economic fallout of the coronavirus. It means that when the recovery does come, for a long time, we're going to see very low or negative interest rates in the developed markets. And because of that, I think the risk profile or the risk appetite of investors and private money will change. And Africa presents an opportunity, especially, you know, for infrastructure and the long-term returns on infrastructure. I just saw, it was in the Financial Times, that by the end of the summer, investors had poured close to $17 trillion into negative yield bonds. I mean, that cannot continue indefinitely. And so I think Africa presents, you know, with, you know, 5 to 7% interest, I think Africa still presents an opportunity for investment. So there is that. The second thing is, you know, the State Department 2 weeks ago, or about maybe 8 days ago, released the Policy Planning Department Bureau at the State Department released this report on the China challenge, and it lists 10 things in terms of how the U.S. is going to organize itself to that China's conduct is the reason China poses a challenge in China's model of leadership. And one of the places where we've seen really growth with setbacks sometimes yet, but in terms of the democratic space, has been in Africa. And I've argued elsewhere that the Chinese model of governance, its desirability or applicability is pretty limited in Africa. And so I can imagine where the democracies of the world, like the US and much of Europe, would see Africa as a place where there's some sort of shared community or values of sorts. And that itself is reason to be able to. And the final thing I would say is, like, you know, as I noted in my comments earlier, I mean, parts of Eastern Europe has been decimated because of the population question. And that's going to affect Western Europe too. And so the only place that will be vibrant with a young population that's working is going to be Africa. And so I think this is something the Chinese saw and were able to make a long-term bet on the continent 20 years ago, when no one saw Africa in a place where you could even think of investment. And today, you know, we're seeing that. So I think there are opportunities for growth, especially in the infrastructure space, especially in the agriculture and agro-processing space, that one would expect Europe, Africa's neighbor, right, to have an interest in investing there. And of course, the United States to invest in there. What I do see, though, is that China is just continuing to deepen its hold. So the Chinese foreign minister has already promised that China will provide support to the Africa Continental Free Trade Area, the Secretariat. They'll provide money for training. And Chinese state media is already entertaining the idea of linking the African Continental Free Trade Area to the BRI and bringing Africa closer into China's sphere. So I think there are reasons, both economic and strategic, for actors other than China to pay attention to what's happening in Africa.
You see on the horizon for financial markets. From uncertainty to opportunity, PGIM can help you rise to the challenges of today when disciplined risk management is needed most. With $1.2 trillion in AUM and deep expertise across asset classes, our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. Those with the ambitious, out-of-reach ideas, begging to become real solutions. They share a vision for how our world and our lives can thrive when bold thinking meets strong silicon. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy through the power of supercomputing. They dream of trust and privacy for all, of advancing and expanding education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to build something better, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
So I wanted to talk a little bit more about what's been happening this year and sort of over the summer. So the distress in African debt is well known, and we've seen the G20 react, as I mentioned in the intro. But I think one of the sticking points or one of the discussion points has been the behavior of the Chinese, whether or not they would agree to some sort of standstill on debt payments or basically act like other creditors, like the multilateral creditors. How big of an issue is that? And do you see signs that China might be softening its stance on this front?
It is a huge issue, and we've heard encouraging things, but it's yet to be seen. So if you go back to the Zambia story, Zambia had gone to its creditors, the private creditors, and asked for a standstill, a deferral. They decided they were going to meet. They put it off to November 13th. And then around, they came back and said no. And so the and then there were recriminations, right? So on the Zambian side, the Zambian finance minister said that the private creditors refused to sign an NDA. And the private creditors wanted to know what kind of arrangement Zambia was having with China. Because the fear was we would defer the debt, we would defer payments, and then Zambia was simply going to pay the Chinese. So they wanted to see. But China, as I noted, is a reluctant multilateralist, and China prefers doing these things on a bilateral basis. Unfortunately, this is not just one of those times, right? I mean, because of the scale of the crisis and the number of actors, it is just not amenable to a bilateral discussion, but China insists on going the bilateral way. And so because of this, the private creditors just felt that there just wasn't enough information, especially about what China was doing, for them to make any decision on that. And so that remains an issue. The second thing was China Exim. This isn't really a huge problem in Africa, but it's a huge problem with the DSSI total. China is arguing that, say, China Development Bank and other policy banks are lending on a commercial basis. And so they ought to be treated the same way private creditors are being treated. That the only Chinese lender who might participate in this is probably China Exim. Well, but China Development Bank is a huge player, not in Africa. In Africa, it lent money to Angola, maybe. And so China is just trying to draw a line between what is, you know, a national, say, a state creditor and what is a private creditor. And so because of this, China has not been eager to participate in this process as one would like. The final thing I would say is that, after the last debt crisis, most of the Western OECD Paris Club members have moved away from bilateral lending. So I think 72% of debt servicing over the next 4 years are to Chinese lenders. And so because of that, China is a dominant player in this new debt crisis, not just in Africa, but just generally. And China's hesitation part of it is China has way more to lose. It's way more leveraged here, right, than most of the G20. So we keep saying G20, but if 70%, 72% is going to China, is there really a G20, right, in terms of the debt question? Is this really China? However, the Saudis, who chaired the G20 now, said that they had agreed in principle on a framework to handle sovereign debt that would be useful going forward. And supposedly the Chinese are on board with this. But again, I mean, in the past, China has, said, they make these general comments that could be yes or no or maybe. So we're yet to see if China is as committed to this new framework, or if China is going to be more active in this space. But it remains that China is such a dominant actor here, and that China's hesitation to fully participate is a significant storyline in the debt crisis.
So does this create a sort of, I mean, it sounds like there was some hole in the existing sovereign debt law or some ambiguity, the situation that allowed this dispute about whether the lending should be characterized as private sector lending or official sector lending. What does a sort of updated version of sovereign debt law look like so that going forward, there's more clarity on how these things are characterized?
Yeah, it just seemed, that after the first, sometime around 2012, 2013, that the IMF would have, I think, look, I wasn't even finance minister in Liberia. I just happened to sit within the presidency and then control a ministry that was pretty big, so that every time there was an IMF mission in Liberia, they met with me as one of the largest spenders in terms of the government. And so everybody knew that this issue of sovereign debt, especially for countries that were just coming into the market, would be an issue. And for some reason, there was never sort of nothing created in terms of an international mechanism to be able to resolve this when it did happen. So this framework would be that. But I think the difficulty with any framework, of course, is going to be when Cote d'Ivoire sells debt for $1 billion or €1 billion, the people buying that debt are, pension funds, hedge funds, private creditors who, have fiduciary responsibilities to their investors and the people whose money they're investing. So this isn't just countries. I mean, with countries, the legislature and the executive can make a decision. Here, because of the strange mix of creditors we have, it creates this difficulty in terms of how one arranges this. So in terms of what this looks like, it's really unclear to me what a new mechanism looks like to be able to handle because this is going to happen as long as these frontier markets continue to have access to international financial markets in terms of debt. We're going to see this happen again. It might be from shocks within the economy or external shocks, but these are going to happen. So how we restructure the international system so that this doesn't happen, to be honest, I don't know. I'm just one of the guys on the sideline who's saying, you know, we need to do this. And when you ask me how, I'd be like, oh, I don't know. So I think, but I'm confident that people who are way smarter than me are thinking about this. But insofar as Africa is concerned, its investment, its infrastructure gap doesn't go away. Its weakness in terms of financing that infrastructure from its budget doesn't go away. And so I think this is just a pause in an inexorable march toward more debt. And I think it makes sense that this framework that the Saudi, we're waiting to see what the framework looks like. And so maybe we can have this conversation again when the framework comes out to see if it is adequate to be able to resolve these kinds of tensions when they arise in the future.
Hmm. Jude, I think that's probably a natural place to leave it. But thank you so much. That was a really interesting conversation and really appreciate your perspective.
Listen, I am really, really happy you reached out, and I'm glad to have participated in this. Thank you.
Yeah, that was fantastic. Thank you so much.
So, Joe, I found that conversation very, very interesting and timely. And I feel a little bit bad because I feel like this is a subject that we probably should have gotten to much faster. But again, as we discussed, given everything that's happening in 2020, there's just lots going on. But I also thought Jude's point about how China's very active in Africa, obviously, but that even the sort of private sector deals, loans that were coming from companies or, you know, deals that were struck with private companies were in some way or another, they end up being financed by the Chinese state. And if you have a private company competing with a state-funded entity, that cost is almost always going to be uneven. And I think the state entity is almost always going to win out. And that was one reason for China's, I guess, advantage in African financing that I hadn't considered before.
Yeah, no, that was extremely interesting. And I hadn't either, this sort of like straddling the line, I guess. And look, I mean, it fits even when we talk about China domestically and this sort of ambiguous nature of the banks and the degree to which they're private enterprises, but also serve policy purposes and policy, economic policy in China domestically, as we've discussed before, is often conducted very directly through the banks. And so I think it's interesting to talk about it from a sort of external standpoint as kind of being the same thing. It's like this sort of unique Chinese financing approach. And this was the sort of the first time we've discussed it sort of outside of China's borders. But fundamentally, it's sort of it's the same thing in some way.
Yeah. And Jude's point about how, you know, we talk about China having extended a bunch of money to Africa, but it's much more nuanced than that. And it's really seven countries that account for the bulk of that financing. And then one in particular, Angola. I think that's a point well taken. But I think the reason everyone's talking about China now or over the summer is because of how it's playing a part in these debt restructuring talks, right? And there are even some people complaining that, you know, no other creditors are going to agree to a deal if they think that China is going to be the holdout. And so any money that, you know, African nations do have ends up getting diverted to China before the rest of the group. So even if China sort of has a smaller role than many people think, it does have an outsized role in these particular debt negotiations.
Yeah, no, that's really well put. And no, I feel like that conversation, it cleared up a lot of things for me, I'd say. And I think also, you know, it's obviously that particular sort of debt buildup and boom, the sort of perfect storm that occurred with African commodity exporters, voracious demand for commodities from China. Like that specific set of scenarios may not be repeated imminently anywhere else. But I mean, obviously, China still has ambitions in terms of expanding its trade and also expanding consumer destinations for its own exports of finished goods. And so the sort of fundamental questions of how Chinese investment works and what makes sense for other countries to accept, that obviously isn't going away.
Yeah. And I got to say, I do hope they finish that railway in Kenya, because that would be very, very helpful. And I can speak from personal experience that when the railways aren't working or there is no railway, actually going along the highways can often be a very, very stressful and extremely dangerous proposition. So I am looking forward to some infrastructure development in Africa. Once we can all travel.
I hope you get to. I don't see that in my in my path anytime soon, but you know, you're more of a globetrotter than me. And so for your sake, I hope you get to experience that finished railway sometime.
You don't think I'm going to go on like a Kenyan railway in 2021? Unrealistic.
Maybe 2022. I don't know, but I'm sure you'll have wonderful Instagram pictures of it regardless. Whenever it is. Thank you.
All right. Well, on that note, shall we leave it there?
Let's leave it there.
Okay. This has been another episode of the Odd Thoughts podcast. I'm Tracy Alloway. You can follow me on Twitter at Tracy Alloway.
And I'm Joe Weisenthal. You can follow me on Twitter at The Stalwart. And you should follow our guest on Twitter, Jude Moore. He's at Jude Moore. Jude is spelled GYUDE_Moore. Follow our producer, Laura Carlson. She's at Laura M. Carlson. Follow the Bloomberg head of podcasts, Francesca Levy, at Francesca Today. And check out all of our podcasts at Bloomberg under the handle at Podcasts. Thanks for listening. Hey there, it's Joe Weisenthal.
And Tracy Alloway.
And we are the co-hosts of the Odd Lots podcast, and we want to tell you about a new podcast here at Bloomberg we're really excited about, Money Stuff, the podcast.
That's right. Friend of the pod, Matt Levine, is teaming up with our other friend and Bloomberg TV host, Katie Greifeld, to bring the Money Stuff newsletter to life. Every Friday, Matt and Katie will dive into all the Wall Street finance and other things that make Matt's newsletter such a hit.
You can listen to Money Stuff the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.